National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
2024 draws to an end. We take stock of what has happened this year at the Vatican and at home in the U.S. EWTN News Senior Vatican Analyst Francis Rocca gives us a look back at the dramatic papal trips, papal teaching, papal prayer of Pope Francis in 2024. Then Register staff writer Peter Laffin walks us through the top events in the U.S. Church this past year. I'm Jeanette DeMello, host of Register Radio. I'm together with Matthew Bunsen, my co-host, and EWTN News' Vice President and Editorial Director. The National Catholic Register's Editor-in-Chief, Shannon Mullen, joins us as well. So the Pope celebrated his 88th birthday a couple weeks ago. He's the oldest Pope in modern history. EWTN News' Senior Vatican Analyst, Frank Rocca, wrote a column in advance of the Pope's birthday. He joins us now. Hi, Frank.
With you.
Frank, so you wrote about how the Pope, the recent popes, have handled what you call the increased burden of age. They've all handled it a little differently. How has Pope Francis handled it compared to his predecessors?
Well, I just wanted to note that the reason I chose that phrase, it comes from a Latin phrase, in gravescens aetas, and I quote that not to be pretentious, but because the Second Vatican Council used those exact words when it said that bishops should resign when they're no longer able to fulfill their duties. And then Paul VI used that as the title of a document in which he limited cardinals to voting at the age of 80. And then Pope Benedict XVI used the same expression when he resigned, and he said he could no longer do it. So it's fair to assume that he was linking this. This is a new way of thinking about episcopal leadership or hierarchical leadership in the church. So we know that Pope Paul VI, Pope John Paul II, and also Pope Francis, we don't know Benedict did this, but he maybe as well, all left instructions of what to do if they were no longer capable, sort of preemptively resigning. But only Benedict resigned. John Paul II, as we know, soldiered on, even though he was very, very ill and very, very visibly ill for years toward the end. And Pope Francis has been continuing, despite his debilities, despite his basically inability to walk and so forth. Benedict chose another path. Benedict chose to step down almost 10 years before he died, because he felt he could no longer do it. So there's a difference in approach.
Yeah, Frank, there's a fascinating paradoxical aspect to the way the church handles age. Of course, as the church, we stress the dignity, respect, and wisdom of years, but there are also age limits obviously set on cardinals and bishops, as we were just talking, but notably not on pontiffs. So how do we make sense of this? But also, with Francis, we're talking about his health. Is there any indication at all that this is someone who could potentially resign? But let's look at the broader question of how he's doing and how his health is.
Well, to take the second part of that first, yeah, I think, you know, he has said in the past that Pope Benedict opened the door to resignation and that he would do the same thing if he ever felt unable. But he's also said several times that he doesn't have any intention to do so. He said it earlier this year. And I think the reason I don't think he will, famous last words, but the reason I don't think he will anytime soon is because he seems to enjoy the job too much. I mean, Benedict, clearly the papacy was a burden for him. He did it as a sense of duty. It was a sense of duty. Whereas I think Francis enjoys being Pope. He enjoys being a leader in this way. So I think even though he's got all these problems, then it's obviously just uncomfortable for him, I don't think he will. As for why there is a retirement age for bishops and for cardinals, but not for popes, I think it's because of the constitution of the church. The pope, according to canon law, possesses supreme, full, immediate, and universal ordinary power in the church. No one can force him to do anything. So I think if Francis, for example, or his successor were to say, popes must resign at 85 or at 90 or whatever, well, that's nothing more than a suggestion. They could have a certain persuasive power, but it won't. It can't bind anyone. And the same goes, by the way, for the suggestions that there should be legislation to govern what ex-pope, what retired popes should do, whether or not they should wear white or whether or not. And the only person who can do that is the successor of a future retired pope, or a future retired Pope himself by setting a model. But it will always only be kind of a suggestion for the future, because popes, by definition, can't be bound by this sort of thing.
Yeah, I always loved that aspect in canon law that when a pope resigns, there it isn't as though the cardinals accept it. It simply happens by force of his own law. So clearly, to your point, the popes really do exercise that authority. Now, Francis, of course, despite these health problems, has soldiered on with these international trips, and he's had some pretty remarkable trips this year. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, he took the longest trip of his pontificate, really harking back to the days of John Paul, when John Paul would take these marathon trips. Francis was gone for 11 days, or 11 or 12, depending on how you count it, in Asia and Oceania. And he went to, and it was an endurance test for, we know from our colleague to accompanied him as journalist, but it was a tough trip. So he's showing, I think, very clearly that he's still in the game, so to speak. And then, of course, he took two other trips. He went to Belgium, a briefer trip, but still. And then he took a very short trip few days ago to by the middle of the month to Corsica for a day.
Frank, in the most recent issue, the December 29th print edition of the Register, you wrote sort of a wrap-up of the year for the Vatican and for Pope Francis. And you wrote about how you saw him really reinforcing some familiar themes of his pontificate. Can you tell us a little bit about what those themes are?
Well, I think that if you had to pick one word, you could say ferment is the way he likes to generate ferment and discussion and I think one of the ways he does that is through what you could call strategic ambiguity. I mean, he for example, the year began with the debate over the same-sex blessing, the blessings for same-sex couples that was permitted in fiducia supplicans, which came out at the end of the previous year. And so there was a great deal of debate on that. And when the African bishops protested, he allowed them to prohibit it, those blessings in Africa. Then later on in the year, he basically played down the significance of the document and said that it was only blessings for individuals. But the document itself talks about couples. So the whole thing remains kind of a question mark. And certainly along the way, he generated a lot of debate. Same thing on women's ordination. He said, kind of surprised everyone, because this has been a question throughout his pontificate, can women be ordained to the diaconate? And he's formed three separate bodies to study the question. And then in an interview in the spring with CBS News of the United States, he said, "Well, no, they can't be ordained. They can't. They can be deacons, maybe in some form, deaconesses or something, but they can't be ordained." Wow. But then later in the year, he accepted as part of his teaching a final synodal document that said that that's an open question and it still needs to be discerned. So again, these questions sort of go up in the air, and people think they have a final answer, but then they realize they don't exactly, and the debate goes on. So I think that epitomizes a wider trend in his pontificate with the synods, for example, to set the table with all kinds of different provocative topics of discussion, but not reach a final conclusion on a lot of them.
Frank, speaking of fiducia supplicans, so the year 2024 really began in that ferment, as you're describing it, because it was just a couple of weeks before that, on December 18th, that Fiducia Supplicans was released. And there was a lot, as the year began, I think, Matthew, also, I think we were bracing for a lot of division and a lot of, there was even talk and articles about schism and so forth. Matt McDonald of the Register recently reached out to all the dioceses in the U.S. to ask them about what the impact has been, and it was a big zero, really. With few exceptions, there doesn't seem to be any real a lot of activity on same-sex blessings in the United States. At least it's not reaching the bishops. Does that surprise you, Matthew and Frank? And why do you think that's the case?
Go ahead, Frank.
Do you want me to answer or Matthew? Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead, Frank.
Well, I think, I mean, it surprised me. I would have said it were only a little while ago we would have thought that would have been an earthquake. But we've sort of gotten used to so many innovations and openings in this pontificate that I think it wasn't quite so shocking. But still it was, and I would have thought, yes. But I think looking back, I think I understand why. I think for those people who are progressives in the church, who think that the church's teaching on sexuality needs to be revised or reinterpreted or something, this is a really, really, really small concession. It's just, I mean, if you listen to the people in Germany who are involved with Synodal Path, who are the sort of the vanguard of progressivism in the church, they're insulted by the idea of blessings. They want marriage. They want same-sex marriage, right? Just as they think the women deacons is only at best a stepping stone to women's ordination, the priesthood, or the episcopate. So for them, this is like, come on. This is. And in fact, Cardinal Fernandez, the head of the dicastery, the doctrinal dicastery, gave an example of a blessing, and it almost sounded like a rebuke, where it said, you know, help free this couple, something, I'm paraphrasing, but help free this couple from anything that stands in the way of their holiness or something. It didn't sound like a celebration. And I think on the other hand, the conservatives, the people who are anxious about this or object to it, are just as happy to let the Pope play it down and just as happy not to talk about it at all. So I think there's a confluence of interest there for this thing to sort of sink. It leaves a trace in the sense that it's kind of an opening that would have been unthinkable under Francis' predecessor. How many people it makes happy, I don't know. I think it's made a lot of people unhappy in one way or another.
Frank, there's no...
I can add really quick that we saw with Cardinal Fernandez, for example, efforts to explain fiducia that didn't necessarily end the controversy, but helped to soften some of it. Then that was followed by Dignitas Infinita, while not directly connected, certainly sort of rhetorically tried to reiterate a lot of church teaching. But at the same time, we then have the passage of time, and the announcement was made that there will be some sort of a Jubilee pilgrimage for the LGBTQ community during the Jubilee year, I think, in next September. So as is always the case with this pontificate, it's always trying to strike a balance between the two, I hate to use the term sides, but the two different movements that we see in the church.
Right. I couldn't agree more. There's just a lot of navigating. I think fermenting and kind of stirring things up and then watching it play out is definitely Francis's way. Frank, you've identified that quite well. And I invite our listeners to go to ncregister.com and take a look at that story that you've written about Francis's year in 2024. Right now, we're going to take a short break. You've been listening to Register Radio on EWTN Radio. Next, we will be talking to Peter Laughlin with a look back at the United States in 2024. Stay tuned to Register Radio here on EWTN.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, host of Register Radio, together with Matthew Bunsen, EWTN News' Vice President and Editorial Director. We are joined by the Register's Editor-in-Chief, Shannon Mullen, and Register Staff Writer, Peter Laughlin. Shannon, I'm going to bring you on very quickly first here. There's a lot of things to talk about in the U.S. This past year. But for the U.S. Church, probably the biggest happening of the year wasn't the presidential election, which is likely the first thing people think of when they think of U.S. It was the Eucharistic Congress, right?
Yes. The Register and its year-end issue has named Eucharistic Revival as the story of the year. And there's a couple of reasons we did that. One is because this was the culmination of a three-year process, and there was even more preparations even before that to put this into place. And there was a lot of people who thought or feared that it would be a failure, that they would have these events, they'd have this Congress in Indianapolis, they'd have these pilgrimages across the United States, and no one would show up, or at least not in any appreciable numbers. And we saw the reverse, you know, the beginning with the pilgrimages, These were four separate routes across the United States, and the images there were so wonderful and moving. E.W. Cann has made a book about it, which is coming out in the new year. And then the Congress itself, about 60,000 people showed up, and the people who were there will tell you something was really happening there. And, so that's what we, that's why it really stood out to us among a very busy year of news in the U.S., which we'll get into with Peter.
So, Peter, I want to bring you on. Politically, this year has been a roller coaster. I mean, I've covered, I guess, four elections. Most election years are roller coasters. But this one seemed different. So, Peter, what stands out most to you about this last year?
Well, I just want to say first, I think Jonathan Liddle said this earlier this year, that it wasn't a coincidence that the Eucharistic Congress was happening in the heat of this presidential election. It was there to remind us of what's really important. So, you know, I love that that was our Register's most important story of the year. The presidential election, the political scene this year in the United States, it's a script that would have been rejected by a Hollywood executive for being implausible. There were so many twists and turns, so many unprecedented moments. But I think in 50 years, what we're going to be talking about still is that assassination attempt of Donald Trump in Boulder. And I think we're going to be talking about it because we're going to be explaining to our kids and grandkids, hey, what are those statues with that man pumping his fist in the air? And I think that was such an incredible moment because Trump really transformed in front of the nation's eyes that day. From being something like a braggart, a clownish figure, all the tweeting and the insults, into something like a folk hero. The MAGA movement gained mainstream acceptance almost immediately. Elon Musk came out and endorsed Donald Trump the very next day. And the nation saw Trump as this man of fortitude. You know, he's coming up against lawfare, against institutional bias, the media, Hollywood. And it was the day he secured the greatest comeback in the history of U.S. politics, maybe history. So I think that's the one that's going to stand out the most in the years to come.
Hey, Peter, about that, I mean, one of the nice year-end features the Register has is we go back to our writers and we ask them, what was your favorite story of the year? And it's often surprising. It's not what I would have thought or what I would have picked. Tell us what your favorite story was and why that made such a big impression on you.
So it was that day in Butler, and I can never get out of my head that the image, the 3D image of Trump turning his head slightly at the last moment to evade the bullet. I still think our national consciousness hasn't processed this. And for me, it was like, wow, I've never seen the hand of God so explicitly moving in history. I don't think we understand what the implications would have been had that bullet just been a centimeter to the side, or had he not turned his head at that last moment. Would there have been an election at all? Would we have broken out into conflict or something like a violent series of, one side hits the other and the other side hits back? And so the next week, I was at the congressional hearing for the Secret Service Director Kimberly Cheadle just before she resigned. And I'll never forget the dumbstruck look on the faces of even the Democrats, who just could not believe that this woman was evading the question so blatantly and giving us nothing. And so it's still a very living story. We still don't understand what happened that day. But I do think we understand pretty clearly that that is what catapulted Trump into some sort of a higher, he's a greater figure now because of that. And I think that's what ultimately catapulted him to the presidency.
Yeah, talking about the campaign, this was also the election year that abortion was supposed to carry the Democrats to a sweeping victory. Why did that strategy, especially for the Harris campaign, seem to fail in rather spectacular fashion?
Oh, it did fail in very spectacular fashion. And I was there at the Democratic National Convention, and abortion was what was on everyone's lips. I also think we'll never forget the fact that at the 2024 Democratic Convention, there was an abortion van outside of the hall where they were performing free abortions and vasectomies for whoever wanted. I think the reason that it failed, Matthew, is because I don't think the Democratic Party adjusted to being in the post-Dobbs era correctly. I don't think they ever made the connection for voters here is what we can do if we have the presidency in order to establish abortion rights. I think there was a lot of cognitive dissonance because we also saw on state ballots, that issue is being voted on directly by the voters. So I don't think they ever made the case, here is what Kamala Harris can do for this. And also it just ended up not driving voters this year. The bigger issues, the economy, immigration, they all seem to be what moved voters. And, one other thing quick on sort of culture issues, culture war issues. The Democrats really lost the culture war issues this time. I think of the transgender issue seem to now, by polling, that they overplayed their hand with that issue and lost the public opinion battle pretty significantly.
Well, talking about also overplaying their hand or moving so far to the left that the country was sort of left behind, we saw throughout this year a number of significant setbacks for gender ideology. What happened? And does this potentially point to other transgender battles in 2025?
Well, it sure does seem like the transgender, the gender ideology movement is on its heels. The Kamala Harris ad that was run, in her own words, that the Trump campaign used of her saying, I would like to give taxpayer-funded sex change operations to criminals. In her own words, that was such a devastating moment that I feel like for the country, the fever kind of broke on gender ideology right at that moment. This happened last week on CNN. There's a lawyer for the ACLU who's very into pushing transgender ideology. And he said on camera, I think it was, well, we know now that if a child is 2 years old, that they know that they want to be in a different body. I saw the reactions to that on Twitter, and it was like, oh, now everybody's seeing that this actually is crazy. It's like the veil was finally lifted, and we can see reality for what it was. This is a lot of absolute craziness. So, they're really on their heels right now. I think we're going to see. I think we're going to see this as part of a much bigger national vibe shift in the coming year.
As our closing question, Peter, I feel like I should ask. I mean, we've been talking about politics, right? And I really want to bring in kind of Catholics, right? What is a particularly Catholic way to remember this year and maybe even our expectations for next year? Is there a way that you can frame this as the biggest Catholic takeaway?
Well, the biggest Catholic takeaway is, well, I'd say that there's two answers to that. The first is that the Catholic vote is a very important voting block in the United States. The Catholic vote broke hard for President Trump, particularly in the swing state, Latino Catholics especially, and that delivered the presidency. And so courting the Catholic vote going forward is going to be on the tip of the minds of political consultants. Now, secondly, moving forward into the second Trump administration, I think Catholics are going to see there's something like, even though Catholics moved to elect Trump, we're going to see something like a mixed bag of results. At least that's what it looks like right now. Donald Trump is the most abortion-friendly Republican president since Gerald Ford. And that's just a fact. And that is going to rub up against Catholic voters in a certain way. And we'll see the implications of that as time goes. The mass deportations that Donald Trump has promised are going to challenge Catholic voters. Where's our loyalty? The Republicans I've spoken to who are involved in planning the political end of the mass deportations, they acknowledge that there's going to be some really scary videos and really scary looking images, really hard to see images. And this is going to press Catholic voters. And so, I think it's going to be a mixed bag. But, Catholics, we're going to have to stick to our principles.
Absolutely, to a fully pro-life, pro-family point of view. I just one more question, and it's a very quick one. What with Elon Musk? He wrote a great profile of him, and he's definitely a figure right now.
Oh, we've never. I spoke with a presidential historian. He's somewhere from Villanova University. I've spoken with a few times for stories, and I could think of no. No other instance in which there was such a powerful figure teamed up, seemingly kind of co-president-ish with a president. And because of his incredible wealth, like incredible that we've never seen before because of the technology behind him. He's got his own satellite company. He's got spaceships. He's got his own fleet of electric cars. He's something like an independent nation. where it feels more like an alliance than it does a political partnership, like an alliance between countries. And there's just no precedent. So it's going to be so fascinating to see how this personal relationship with these two unfolds in the coming couple of years. Will we be talking in 2 years about Elon Musk and Donald Trump, who are the sworn historic political enemies? It's possible.
It is possible. So I want to point to the December 29th print edition where our listeners can read about all that we've been talking about. There is a profile in that, What Should Catholics Make of Elon Musk? But there is also year-end material there at your fingertips. Also, it's available at ncregister.com. So for more news, analysis, and commentary, please check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. As always, thanks for joining us here on Register Radio on EWTN. Until next week, on behalf of my producer, Rich Jesse, myself, Jeanette DeMello, my co-host, Matthew Bunsen, as well as Shannon Mullen, we wish you a happy new year.